Okay, let's start up and do the final section. As we broke, I was saying that I thought the automaton at the bottom was reasonably readable in terms of showing what you liked and didn't like. The equivalent definition as a regular expression is up top, and somehow that's a little less readable to my thinking, but it's certainly not opaque. So the way to read many of these things is from outside in or from subcomponents. So in this case, notice you really have two components with the vertical bar. So the one on the right says I can have zero or more digits, followed by a decimal point, followed by one or more digits. So this represents the ability to take something of 12.34 or 0.12. So those two are possible. The thing on the left says I can read a sequence of digits and stop by matching lambda, or I can read a sequence of digits and stop with the decimal point. But notice this thing does not allow a decimal point by itself, because the only way to get it is to be inside the lambda or dot, and to its left has to be one or more digits. So it certainly disallows a single decimal. Now, depending on which one of those you feel more comfortable, the cool thing is they're interchangeable. So it's almost like if you're bilingual, use your own language or use somebody else's language, and or even kind of intermix them. So sometimes I'm in an elevator and going along and somebody who's speaking some Hindi or some other Asian language be chomping along and understand a word, then all of a sudden they'll say somebody's name, like Professor Solomon, blah, 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 Professor Solomon, blah, blah, blah. And I'm trying to figure out, you know, they say he's a great fellow, he's a terrible fellow, I just saw a bum on the street who looked just like him or whatever. And these sort of things, too, you can switch over to whichever you feel more comfortable, not on an individual word basis, but certainly in terms of understanding. Here's another one, and again, we'll try to do a trick here, that sometimes identifiers are allowed to have underscores, and you may have seen that, A underscore B. Those are kind of nice when you want to have an identifier that has obvious breaks in them. And what we do sometimes is simply have a change in case. So if we had sum of 10, we could say sum underscore of underscore 10, or alternatively sum of becomes capital O, and T and 10 becomes capitalized. Let's look at this one which has been generalized so that we have underscores. But notice it's not quite as simple as that, because the situation here is we don't want to have underscore ending an identifier. Reason for that is look may look way too much like a minus sign. And we don't want two consecutive underscores, because we may get something like, at that bottom line, you see grand total. For some reason, that thing saw two underscores and made it a heavy dash. I don't know why, but you can see the problem there is two you can probably tell, but if you had three or four, again, it's a little unreadable. How many underscores do I have? I have a dash. But is it a small dash, a medium, a large, an extra large, or whatever? So I say, okay, I'm going to give you an underscore, but here's the rule. They can be like ordinary identifiers in that begin with a letter and have letters or digits. If you put an underscore in, it's got to be in the middle, can't be at the end, and you can't have two consecutive underscores. So looking at the thing up top, I say, okay, the thing at the left is an ordinary identifier, and since that thing at the right has a star on it, I could stop. Think of the thing on the right is generating one or more suffixes, which has an underscore and some more letters and digits. So the thing at the right says if you put an underscore, you've got to have at least one more letter or digit, and you can repeat it. So that means I can't have an underscore that ends the whole identifier, nor can I have two underscores, because each underscore has to be followed by a letter or a digit or more. So that's reading the regular expression form. But this thing, I think, is even simpler. I mean, look at this. It's the thing up top has several operators. The thing at the bottom says, okay, I can go to a letter, and then I can go to the top arc and say letters or digits. So the top two parts are just like an identifier. The thing going over there, again, that's an underscore. It kind of looks like a minus. In isolation, that's always a problem. It says, yeah, you can have an underscore, but you're not done yet. And you can come back there and read another letter or digit, and read some more letters or digits. If you want another underscore, you got to go to the right state, and before you terminate, you got to find at least one more letter or digit. So these two both mean the same thing, but I think intuitively, my feeling is the bottom one is more readable. That's just my thinking. But they are interchangeable, yeah. No, neither of them allows you to start with an underscore. The thing at the top, notice the thing at the left says, I've got to have a letter followed by letters or digits before you ever get to underscore land. So I'm protected. Neither of them allow that, right? In fact, that's a good thing when you're doing assignment one. This is sort of the thing when you see an expression. It's got, again, these two problems. Does it accept too much? This could accept everything that's good, but as the gentleman suggested, maybe it allowed me to begin with an underscore. So that means I'm allowing too much, I'm allowing a bad string in. But it might be also that I had programmed it somehow so that some good thing was disallowed. So it might, for example, allow me only to have one underscore and not two or three. So I could have main-body, but I couldn't have cost of one because that would have two underscores. So you have to kind of say, does it allow too much or too little? So it's almost like Goldilocks. You can't have something that's too hot and not too cold. It's got to be just right. And if so, you got it. So that's the power of this kind of notation. You've got to make sure that it says what you want. And remember, these are computers, and computers will do what you tell them to do. It's not like the laws of robotics or something that, you know, when you have a robot, a robot will never do anything that harms a human, right? That's the first law of robotics, and there's several others, situation there. We're not nearly there yet. You tell a program to do stupid things, it may do stupid things. And we've all had occurrences of that, but it's something we have to understand. We're the masters, and if we tell it to do something stupid, we can't really count on it, at least not yet, to tell us no. And I'm not sure if I ever want to get to the point where the computer simply says, no, I'm not going to follow your program because you don't know what you're doing and I do. It'll maybe get there, but it'll be a sad day for me. I'll go back and take an old computer and live with it. So at this stage, I told you all I need to do about actually programming tokens. Now we're going to get into the part where it says, here's an actual tool. There's a whole variety of families there. Lex goes all the way back to the early Unix days. Flex was a faster Lex. That's back maybe 20 years. And JLex is going back to the dawn of Java, 10 or 15 years, whatever it might happen to be. We're using JLex, where J stands for Java. So it's like the original Lex program, but it's in Java. And because our program's in Java, that makes sense. So what this thing is going to do is actually go ahead and take a specification that has a little bit of Java mixed in, but a lot of regular expression notation, and figure out what sort of scanner it has to build that would recognize the tokens that you've defined. The cool thing about this is that in many cases, each of the token definitions is totally independent. So if you're working on a team, some one person can be working on this set and the other set can be worked by somebody else, and you hardly step on each other's toes. That's kind of a rarity. If you've been doing programming in Java, you notice that having two people working on the same Java class is tricky. And turns out there's all sorts of tools available to be able to have the two people coincide or actually synchronize their coding so one does not step on the other. We can talk about that if you want at some point. But certainly here, they have the same problem. If a team is working on a project, one person can't change the other person's code without clearing it with them, or otherwise you have chaos of who's doing what and how are they synchronized. So in this particular case, it's almost never the case. There are a couple, but almost never the case that the ordering matters. And if the ordering matters, it matters only in the weakest sense, which I'll be telling you about. So, again, as I mentioned several times, I want to repeat it. This is a non-procedural language. You're not telling it how to match characters against a particular token def. You're saying, here are the token defs I want when you match it, and it's up to you. So you just go in. If you ever find a character sequence that matches my def here, go and do that. And do that means I'll have a block of code written in Java that I want done. Could be a simple thing, or it could be a complex call to any kind of method that does a lot of processing, but it tells me when it's found the right characters, and I tell it what to do with them. Some cases I do very little, other cases I may do more. if you've ever done a lot of low-level programming, this saves you a lot. For example, I've mentioned the fact that there's no limit on the size of an identifier. Well, in the early days of Lex, that was a big problem because in those days, arrays were fixed size. So if you said, okay, I'm going to have a token and I'll allocate 50 characters, God help you if you had 51 or 52. In many cases, what would happen is you keep reading beyond the end of the array and start overwriting other parts of memory. In fact, that's the basis of a lot of early hacks that would actually break a Unix program by doing something that the language really didn't support, like having a string longer than what was allowed. Flex fixed that by being more flexible. But in your case, if you're a programmer, you'd have to say, I don't know how long this thing is going to be. I got to be prepared for as long, many characters as they throw at me. Dozens, hundreds, maybe thousands. And in this case, you don't have to worry about it. It's programmed into JLEX, and however it handles it, and you don't worry about it. So JLEX is coded in Java. One of the nice things about using to build XML and ANT that I warned you about is this sort of thing will be done for you automatically within Eclipse if you use the build.xml. Starting at 1, but the other ones also. There's a particular file that specifies the particular tokens we want and a call to a routine, JLEX, that takes that file and generates an actual scanner file full of code that says, read this character, look it up in the table, read that character, look it up in the table. A lot of low-level detail that you run, but you never have to program. And that's the big plus. In fact, you might want to make a mental note if you're working on Project 1. If you go ahead and look up, as I'll show you, the name of the file would be something suffixed with JLEX. So I guess in problem 1, we give you light.jlex. And there's something that generates a scanner from that particular file. The number of lines in the light.jlex is 100, maybe 150. It turns out in the generated code, it's more like 500. So you kind of get a leverage of 2 or 3 to 1 in terms of raw programming, and you get to avoid a lot of very boring but very error-prone coding where you have to fill a table, did I put the right number in the right spot when I was doing it? JLEX does all of that, and you don't worry about it. And this class path, so this is relevant if you're not running Eclipse. If you're running Eclipse, Eclipse handles class paths for you. That's one of its pluses. You knew there had to be some reason to use Eclipse. Now, it gives you so much grief, there had to be something decent it did, and that was one of them. So what will happen is if my input was, instead of f.jlex, it was light.jlex, light.jlex.java would be created. In fact, I already created it for you. It's sitting in the Project 1 portfolio there, or the Project Def, and you can go ahead actually and look at it. Don't change it because it's automatically generated, but you can kind of see the stuff that it's generating for you. And f.jlex.java is simply an ordinary Java program, so you just run it using a standard Java compiler, and out comes a working scanner for you. So it generates a class called yylex, and that's the one that's generated, and it contains some methods you want to call. So first question is, why is it called yylex? For the worst of all possible reasons, probably, historical precedent. What happened is, in the early days of Lex, Lex would generate programs in an environment where there were lots of other C programs sitting around. So they had no real control of them. What happens if you generate something called scanner and I generate something called scanner? They're going to step on each other's toes, the linker may not work, etc. So what they did said is anything we generate is going to have a YY in front of it. And the YY is such a weird prefix that no other sane programmer will ever use it, we hope. If they don't, then anything it generates having a YY prefix won't step on anybody else's toes. These days, handling conflicts is a little better control, but for historic purposes, you always generated something called YY this or YY that, so they're doing it too. So think of it as kind of an homage to the original program. So it contains a method called YYLEX, and actually we give you a little code that will call that. So when you're building the AST through a parser, what the parser will do is says, I need a token. It'll call YYLEX and say, give me one. The scanner part will activate and read some characters and says, this is a complete token. And moreover, it's an identifier. And moreover, the identifier's text is maybe ABC. It will then process that particular token through the parser and say, hey, good, give me another one. So you can see it bouncing back and forth. Give me a token, use it. Give me a token, use it. And it all integrates fairly nicely. The constructor that you want scanned is system.in, but you can actually change that. So I change that to the name of a file that you specify. And system.in, that token is a token class that you'll actually be generating. So you get to specify the kind of tokens you want. YY text is something that's useful. So mark that one down if you have paper. Because in some cases, when you've actually done scanning, you say, hey, I just found an integer literal. But which one? There's lots of them. There's an unlimited number of integers, after all. And it says, well, YY text will be the actual sequence of characters, presumably digits, that we just scan. And you can do anything you want with it. So typically what the scanner will do is pass it along to the parser and later to the code generator, saying, here is a token, and here are the characters that represents it. In many cases, I think we change it from a character string to a real integer, just because integers ought to be represented as integers. But that's an easy thing to do. So in terms of JLEX, there's three sections. Only one of them is really important and one you have to focus on. So the double pound sign is just a delimiter. Again, they chose it because it's not usually an operator. So think of it as just like a horizontal line. But this was done in the old days when we didn't have really high-quality monitors where you could actually draw something like a horizontal line or change color or something. It was all in terms of characters. So the double percent sign is just a delimiter. So the user code is something we'll talk about. The JLEX derivative directives is very important. And the regular expression rules are the most important. And we'll see examples of that. So the user code is essentially something that we're given. So we actually give you that part, and I don't think you need to change that. So for example, we might create a token called int lit token, and this would be for tokens that are integer literals. It would have a code saying, I'm an integer literal, and a number or a string saying, here's my value. So the first section here is something where you can have various pieces of code copied into the particular program being generated. So you see that percent brace and close percent brace is code that will be copied into the JLEX class. I don't think you need that, but if you want to add some methods or fields, that's the way to do it. .eof brace to close EOF brace percent is code that's executed to end the file. We give you a little bit of that. I think you can use that as it is. And class name is the gives you the ability to name the type that YYLEX will return. Again, these are needed, but they're pretty standard. I did something earlier on that I want to explain more fully now, namely, in some cases where I wanted to have a particular class of characters, like digits or letters, I simply wrote down, I'll give it a name, like D or L. Well, you can do a similar thing in JLEX, and what you do is create what's called a macro. A macro allows you to give a name to a pattern which might otherwise be unreadable. So you could give something like a pattern that says string body, meaning this would be the body of a string, and again, that will have some components. So just looking at the individual items wouldn't tell you much. So it's like the notion of taking a particular value and giving it a good name so you know exactly what it really represents. Basically, the form is very easy. It's like an assignment. Here's a name and equal to a definition. They're defined one per line, and here's some examples. And again, I'm getting a little bit ahead, but the 0 through 9 in square brackets means that it's any of the 10 digits. Any let means it's a representation of a character set from A to Z capital and also A to Z lowercase, so a total of 52. So these are names, instead of even that pattern, I can call a digit or any let. And the way you tell it that it's a macro you want expanded is by putting braces around it. So if I put down brace, digit, close brace, it says go back to that definition, and what I really want is 0 through 9. So it gives you the ability to give names to various groups of characters, making it more readable. The regular expression rules, the third part, are really the most important. This is where you'll spend 90% of your time in using JLEX. So it's the form of a regular expression rule, and we'll get into the form of that, and then embraces Java code. And here's the part where I said the order almost doesn't matter. Each regular expression will be a different token, and the tokens, for the most part, will be independent. One token won't step on another. So it says, when you see this particular kind of token, here's what I want you to do. Typically, it'll be something, because the scanner is being called, it'll return something, and what it'll return is a particular token class, possibly with some additional information, like the value of a string or the value of a number. So what happens is, when regular expression is matched, how? Not my problem. Turns out that it's up to JLEX to figure out. It says, if it sees this pattern, and you're quite sure the characters read match that, I want you to execute this code. It'll either then return, or in some cases, it'll resume scanning. So this is kind of nice, because this is exactly what I was talking about, where you say that you say what, but not how. So it says, I want you to match that pattern and do this. But I'm not telling you how to figure out when that pattern has actually been found in the input characters. You've got to read characters, match them. Is it equal to this, equal to that? Go into this table, etc. But once you figure it out, go ahead and do it. So my programming part is the easy part. Here's the pattern, and here's what I want done. So usually what will happen is we'll return a token class, but in some cases we'll simply resume scanning. So let's look at some simple ones just to get you comfortable. What happens is regular expressions are up top. Remember, if something's special, it has to be escaped. Since we're working in a Java-like system, strings are double-quoted. So I don't want plus misunderstood as the repetition matcher. So I say, if you see a plus in quotes, here's what I want you to do. I want you to create a new token, and its particular identifier is sim.plus. There's a class sim that I've given you that has all the various tokens that might possibly be created. And for each of those, it has a code number. You don't have to use the code number, but the scanner will use it. So it says sim.plus is what tells the parser that the token is a plus, because it's got the code associated with a plus. So the scanner knows there's a plus, and the parser knows there's a plus, and they use the same code number to represent that. Here's one where I don't return at all. I said, if I see some white space, in this case blanks, in between tokens, I'm going to ignore it. So blanks typically between tokens is ignored, not necessarily inside tokens or inside, say, a string or inside a quoted character. And I put the comment in there just for readability. So it says, okay, if you see one or more blanks, what am I to do? I match them, and then I say skip them, so it'll go back and resume scanning, because I didn't tell it to return something immediately to the parser. Here's a tad more complex one. This is not quite what you want to do fully, because it doesn't handle minuses, but it's not too far off. It says, what's digit 0 through 9? So if you see a run of digits, here's what I want you to do. And again, this is spread over several lines just because I wanted it to fit cleanly. I want you to return something. What? Well, I want you to return not just an ordinary token, but a new intlet token. And its code is going to be intlet. So the parser will see that number and say, hey, this particular token is an integer literal, but I also want to give you the exact numeric value. So in this particular case, it'd be a situation where I say, yytext is exactly the characters you matched. Go ahead and get its value as an integer. And remember, strings have all kinds of cool methods. And one of them they have is int value. And take that int value and make myself a token class of cap I integer. And return that along with the token. So the token will come back, and the class representing the integer value will also be returned. So to make this all work, we have to figure out how in JLEX to represent regular expressions. So those of you who are puzzled by homework one, where we had down bottom JLEX notation, here's where we're going to talk about it. So JLEX notation is very much like regular expressions, except it's linearized, so it's more readily typable inside of a computer. So we don't have superscripts or subscripts. We just have a run of characters. So input characters that match a regular expression are read as the code is executed. You don't need to tell it, it does it itself. Tokens like white space are deleted simply by not returning, simply matching and letting the scanner continue. So the scanner can skip things like comments and white space that the rest of the program doesn't care about. But for anything that's important, it'll do a return of a token back to the parser, which will then use it to build the AST. So it'll figure out how many characters to read. We'll give you the rules, but they're very simple. So the simplest form of regular expression is a string that matches itself. For example, if I want to do if. Now, this is incomplete because in our language, if could be uppercase or lowercase or mixed. But let's take a simpler version. IF represents the character I and F. If you want, you could quote it, but you don't need to because there's nothing magic about I and F. And it says, if you match IF, return a new token and give it the code number of sim.if. That is, I read an if. No further information is needed because all ifs are created equal. Nothing different about them. As I said, if you want, you could quote it. Don't have to, but if you feel good about doing it, go ahead. If you have certain symbols like plus that are being used not as an operator but as their actual character, then quoting is necessary. So in this case, if I wanted to return the plus representing addition, I'd say return me the brand new token that's sim.plus. So that represents the token for plus. Something I talked a little bit about, but I want to get back to, is character classes. This is where you can put a set of characters together in one particular notation. So character classes are represented by square brackets, and inside them, let me make this very clear, inside square brackets, there are not strings, there are characters. That's why they're called character classes. So if you look at the thing near the bottom, you see square bracket XYZ, that's not the string XYZ, it's X or Y or Z. Why don't I put a comma or a vertical bar? Because I don't need to. Each character is one character long, and implicitly say, don't read this as one word, read it as three characters, and in this particular case, that could be in any order. Because ordering doesn't matter, I could say square bracket ZYX and get the same effect. So square brackets have some special operators that we'll talk about, but they represent a set of individual characters that can be used as part of a regular expression. Certain characters may need to be escaped, just like we talked about escaping in strings. So for example, if I want to include the close bracket in a character class, I have to escape it, because otherwise it would be misinterpreted as closing a character class. So the thing I have, bottom minus one, says give me the character class that contains a closed square bracket or a closed paren. I don't need to escape the paren because parens group at the regular expression level, not at the character level. So it matches a single closed bracket or single closed paren. And again, the closed bracket is escaped, so it's not misinterpreted. Here's the really powerful parts. There are two operators that are really very useful. One of them I showed you, and that's the dash or minus. It's not a subtraction. It's a range. So if I have one character, a dash, another character, it says give me all the characters in the character class starting with X and all the way to Z. If I have 0-9, that means the 10 digits. I can use dash more than once. So A-Z lowercase and A-Z uppercase is all upper and lowercase letters. And let's see what we have. And I use this. This is a good spot to take up next time, so why don't we break right here? And at this stage, read on a little bit ahead. I have more notes I didn't get to. And at that stage, you should be ready to be able to look at homework one if you wish and start worrying about how to answer it. It's in JLUX notation, but this and what follows describes JLUX pretty appropriately. So we'll see you on Thursday. The TA will be on Wednesday and Friday, and I'll also be back on Monday.